When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful, live. Welcome to the stage, Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyds.
Hello. Ed just asked if he was too casual. What do we think?
You look great.
I think we should congratulate our audience for coming, actually, don't you think?
Thank you. We do appreciate you coming out tonight. And we've been affected.
We have been affected, yeah.
One of our guests, who Sue. Is going to be with us, yeah. Sue, isn't here because she's we don't want to say who she came into contact with, do we?
Social isolation, anyway.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
She's really gutted not to be doing it.
Absolutely. So what are we talking about this evening, then?
We are talking about land and how we use land and sustainable farming, which is a really important subject because it is, I think, 12% of our carbon emissions come from the way we use land. It's a matter of debate, and it's, I think it is really interesting that the way the culture is changing. We talked on the podcast about veganuary. You're already there. Well, you're there as a vegetarian.
Yeah. I'd say I'm nudging up against 70% vegan at this point.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that up from, like, your Uber rating? Is that up from what it used to be?
Very much so. That's where the rest of my focus has been.
What's your favourite vegan dish? Not that you've ever cooked it for me, but anyway, what is your favourite vegan dish?
Brussels sprouts in miso are pretty good. I am gutted that the local Whole Foods is out of them. But you got
is that like a main meal, Brussels sprouts and miso?
It can be, yeah. Now, I have to say, before we get on with the show, I learned something quite shocking about Ed just before we came out here tonight.
Well, I'm going to be spending Saturday afternoon at a driver vehicle awareness course. Yeah, I know. I thought I would confess.
The thing is, I'm now going to
make excuses and make it even worse. I mean, at least I took the points myself, or not the points, actually, in this case, but the driver vehicle awareness course myself.
But you did ask me.
I did not. I can't drive.
I did not ask you.
No, it's because it was the day after the general election, and I think it was like 57 in a 50-mile-an-hour zone.
Hang on, it was the day after the general election and you wanted to get back to Westminster?
Yeah, I suppose that is a bit ironic. Wow. I want to get back to see my family.
Right.
So it's bad, yeah. But I'm going to be spending 4 hours in the Crown Plaza in Ealing, if any of you would like to come along to learn about my vehicle awareness.
How far did we get in talking about what we're doing?
We haven't talked about Robin.
So there's that, and then coming to give us some potential reasons to be cheerful, to share some ideas, we have one of our finest comedians. You'll know him from The Infinite Monkey Cage on Radio 4. It's Robin Ince.
Yeah.
That's exciting. Ooh.
What's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful is, you know what's coming, and by the time this podcast is released,
I don't know what's coming.
On Monday, and it will only be a day away, the equinox. So it's when, I think it's when I bet Robin Ince will know exactly what it is, but I believe it's when the days are as dark as they are light.
I totally agree with you, but I didn't know that was the word.
Yeah, is this somebody who could just... It's not the same as the equinox. It's slightly different. That's a little bit later. Is anybody who can just help me out with exactly what the equinox is?
No.
No, that's fine. In fact, can I just go back on what I said? It was exactly how I described it.
Well, what's the equinox, then?
You don't need to know about the equinox.
You don't know.
Let's just look forward to the equinox.
Yeah, okay. Well,
let's not wish our lives away.
I know November is like so depressing. I mean, I know we're not in November, but November is so so depressing, isn't it?
It's behind us now.
It's behind us
and ahead of
well,
us.
Well, I mean, yeah,
that's how time works.
Coming up as well.
What's your reason?
That's what you get the big bucks for.
What's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful is that I am writing a book, of ideas based on the podcast. And it's going to come out later this year, and it's called Go Big, and you can pre-order it. So it's a shameless plug, and it's quite exciting.
That's great. So is it going to be hardback?
Hardback and paperback, hopefully. I mean, if it does really badly, it won't go to paperback, but I mean, assuming it doesn't. So it's exciting.
And are you self-publishing, or is somebody actually... It's not like vanity press.
Yeah, I'm self-publishing.
Like Fifty Shades of Grey.
Yeah, I'm sort of doing the photocopying myself.
That's how we describe our hair.
But you can also pre-order it. Have I mentioned that? So I'd like you all to pre-order it.
So have you thought about what the cover will look like? So, you know,
there is a cover, actually. You can see the cover.
That's good news.
Yeah. Why?
It's some loosely bound pages.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations. I look forward to that. When's that coming out?
When it's written. It's somewhat written. By the end of the year, I'm saying, to be safe. Shall we?
Let's.
Okay, so can you welcome our guests who I failed to introduce earlier, Belinda Gordon, who is Strategy Director at Green Alliance, and Vicky Hurd, Sustainable Farming Coordinator at Sustain. So, we are talking about farming, land, and all of that. I suppose I'd start by saying, as somebody who grew up in a city, mainly in London, we haven't really had to think about land use, have we, for the last few decades? I mean, it's just not the kind of thing that we've thought about, and we kind of need to, don't we? And maybe you can explain, and Belinda, I'll come to you first, so why?
Yeah, so our, as you said, our emissions, greenhouse gas emissions from land use are about 12% of the UK's emissions. And the problem is that, not huge, but the problem is that the emissions from land use haven't been coming down in the way that they have from other sectors. So proportionally, it's really growing. And that's why we need to start paying some attention to it. And then also, you know, so it can play a role in climate change, but there's also a nature crisis. You know, in my lifetime, the number of farmland birds has dropped by more than half, which is just incredible. I'm not that old, so you know. there are these sort of twin environmental crises that land can really help play a role in, not only by reducing emissions, restoring nature, but also, you know, land can act as a carbon sink. So it's not just reducing emissions, it can help play a part in solving the climate change problem.
And just to underline this point, while emissions from power have gone down a lot,
yeah,
basically in other sectors it's been flatlining,
yeah,
and farming is one of them.
Farming is particularly one of them. So, yeah, you know, the UK's sort of journey towards net zero emissions has been pretty good so far, but it is largely due to the power sector, so the switch to renewables, which which is an amazing success story, but it hasn't really affected all of our lives that much. You know, we still flick a switch and the lights come on, whereas these other sectors, like sort of transport, the way we heat our homes, and you know, the food we eat and the landscapes we enjoy, they are going to have to change, and that is going to affect us a lot more, and they haven't been so far.
And what would that transformation to net zero look like from a land perspective?
Well, I mean, there's loads of different scenarios. There's, you know, depending on who you're talking to, you could be saying a huge amount of crops being fed to our power stations, and that would be energy crops in, you know, big monocrops, which wouldn't really be serving us food that we need. It wouldn't be sorting the nature crisis. So we're looking for a real mixture. Each farm have a mixture of trees and really good pasture if they've got livestock, and a mixture of crops. So diversifying the cropping system, because that is really good for nature. We know that, and having a mixed system. But it's also inevitably better for the soil, which can actually draw down a lot of that carbon that we're talking about. So you've got carbon sequestered into the soil, trees locking in soil, and providing a more diverse diet and a better system for nature. So there is a solution. There is a reason
to be careful. Can we just underline this point about that that part of the challenge here is that we could end up importing lots of meat and essentially exporting our emissions. So lots of farmers could go out of business, but we still wouldn't really have solved the problem.
Yeah.
Or conversely, we could end up with farmers still producing beef and lamb and so on and exporting our emissions that way.
Yeah,
so you've got to act on both what we consume and what we produce. Yeah.
So I think that's true. You know, we're locked into these global supply chains, and it isn't just for food products. It's the same for anything we manufacture. So we could, you know, really reduce our greenhouse gas emissions domestically and say, great, job done, but we're still consuming stuff that is being brought from overseas.
And just to be clear about this, just on the sort of emissions that come from beef and lamb, say, as against, you know, if you had a beef burger versus having a soya burger, what's the order of magnitude here?
It's probably at least, at the very least, sort of 7 times worse in terms of carbon emissions.
And just explain why that is, Belinda.
Well, it's a sort of variety of reasons, but one is that it's just less efficient to eat an animal that's eaten a load of plants than for us just to eat the plants ourselves. And so there's lots of wastage in that system, whereas if you eat the plant, there's less wastage. And then there's the problem of cows and sheep burping. It's not so much farting, I'm afraid. It's
burping rather than farting.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
No, I didn't. Yeah. And their emissions.
The fart's sort of all right. They just fart less
because they have 5 stomachs. It all comes out this way,
and it's methane, which is incredibly powerful greenhouse gas.
Yeah, no, did you know that about the burping and the farting?
No, I didn't. I'd always heard it was farting. This has already been educational.
The burping's less glamorous, you know.
Right.
They're less exciting.
And there's a sort of funny thing though here, which is that you're saying that we've not made any difference. People have started to change in terms of what they eat, haven't they?
They have. There's been a really big shift, and you can see that because the supermarkets have responded.
Yeah.
They're putting a lot more products on the shelf which are less meat or no meat, and not necessarily calling it vegan or vegetarian. They're just sort of presenting it to us, and people are eating it. Particularly younger generations are really embracing that change. So I think that's a good thing, that we should, that trend should be going in the right direction, because we've been going in the wrong direction. You know, really big juggernaut of bad food for 40, 50 years. We need to change that juggernaut round, and it's starting already, but we need a lot of other things to happen for that to really be embraced by a lot of people and be, you know, a good diet for everybody.
So the sort of diet gets lots of attention, but another less glamorous thing that doesn't get so much attention is food waste, which is
right.
Just, you know, such an inefficient use of resources, and you know, depending on how it's treated, can produce loads of emissions as it breaks down. And so that's, you know, something that we can all play a role in reducing, as well as the dietary shift.
And how prominent is this as an issue within the farming industry?
Oh, very big, very big. I've seen some really positive shifts in the farming industry. I was talking about the retailers, and they're a big problem because they're squeezing farmers, you know, a lot for, you know, lower prices, harder deals. But a lot of farmers are looking to do things differently. Even the National Farmers Union have announced a net zero target. But they've got a long way to go, but they need to be supported by industry and by government in that change. But I think they are listening, and I think there's a very small percentage that are climate deniers or anything like that. I think that's a definite change.
And let's go on to solutions and talk about individuals, farmers and landowners and governments. First of all, let's start with individuals. Some of this is going to be obvious to our audience, some of it maybe not. What can individuals do? I'm not asking you for sort of kind of necessarily to tell us exactly what we should eat, but give us a sense of the scale of change there needs to be, because there is a debate about this, isn't there? I mean, at one level, the Climate Change Committee assumes, I think, a 20% reduction
in
the next 30 years in beef and lamb consumption, but that is seen as a relatively low figure. The public health numbers are much more like in the 70% range.
They're thinking about some of the health benefits of having a healthier diet with lower red meat and processed red meat, which is known to be better. But I think you're right. I think we need to be more ambitious. But at the same time, it depends what you eat now. If you're eating a high meat diet, that's not very healthy and it's certainly not sustainable. So you should cut it down. If you're not eating much now, you're probably okay. You've got a good, sustainable diet. But you also got to think about cutting junk. You know, if we're eating junk food, it's really bad for us. It's using a lot of land for sugar and for rubbish in your diet. Let's cut junk and you'll be healthier and more sustainable. And so, and wasting less, as you said, that's a really key thing. And eating more fruit and veg impulses is a great thing for your diet.
Is there a danger of sort of junk vegetarian food?
There is. Definitely. And there is a lot out there. I've seen it. My son went a bit vegan about 2 years ago and he stopped now. But, the proliferation of really heavily processed, salty, junk vegan food was
dirty vegan, they call it.
Yeah. Well, dirt is good. I love dirt.
Are you a dirty vegan?
I wish
on a weekend.
Yeah. But a bit of dirty veganism's all right.
Yeah, absolutely. Everything in moderation and we've gone way the wrong way. Let's go back.
How is the behaviour change going to happen? Because... there's this debate about price, isn't there?
There has been lots of talk of a meat tax. I personally think that could cause a real sort of culture war.
Yeah.
But I do think we should look at the tax system as a whole. You know, VAT could be replaced by a materials-based tax that would go... So that would go across everything we consume and make low-carbon goods much cheaper and incentivize the purchase of those. So,
could you subsidize vegetarian food?
I don't think.
You could support horticulture producers better.
Yeah.
So we get more affordable and available fresh fruit and veg.
I mean, farming is, I don't like to use the word subsidy, but a lot of public money.
Veggie burger bonus?
a lot of public money goes into farming.
Veggie burger price freeze.
That can be tailored better.
Yeah. But I mean, it is the pricing is a problem, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, I think the pricing of all goods is a problem in terms of it doesn't incorporate the environmental footprint that's created in making those goods.
The price isn't right.
Yeah, the price.
Sorry to use your game.
So do you think, you want some action on subsidy and so on, but do you think how else can behaviour change happen among individuals? I mean, do you think education can do it?
Well, there's loads of interesting research about, nudge, the little things you can do. So actually, I heard a presentation earlier in the week about putting the vegetarian option first before the meat option. And that really, depending on the distance, that really increased the consumption of the vegetarian option. Just putting out.
So people are too lazy to read down a menu.
No, it's actually about walking into a cafeteria. Right. They're too lazy to walk like a meter and look at the meat option.
You mentioned the VAT idea before. I'm wondering what else government can do, and also will Brexit make a difference to that? Because we've been sold this idea, I don't know if rightly or wrongly, that the EU has dictated a lot of agricultural and farming policy for a long time. Yeah. Is there some opportunity? You know, have we finally found a reason to be cheerful around Brexit?
Yeah, I mean, there is a huge opportunity. We're leaving the common agricultural policy, which meant that farmers in the UK were paid our taxpayers' money based purely on the amount of land they owned. So the bigger the landowner, the more money they got, which was just really perverse. And the government do seem to be taking advantage of this opportunity, and there's an agriculture bill currently going through which is going to shift public money so that it goes for goods that we can all enjoy, benefits we can all enjoy, things like reduced farming in ways that reduce flooding, that restore nature, that reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So that is a fantastic opportunity, and the government seem to be grasping it. So that is definitely a reason to be cheerful.
And what else can government be doing on this?
Well, we're interested in them getting the right menus in places where people have to eat, like schools, hospitals, care homes, the armed forces, getting those, they could overnight set a really solid standard so that it's good menu with the right amount of meat and the right amount of fruit and
veg. And so government could make a big difference
they
in
could.
The public
and procurement. We've had loads of initiatives that have done really very little, but you also need to have the money to and the right resources to pay for that. But we also need one big whopping great promise from the government to not allow trade deals to undermine what was just being talked about.
Is not just chlorinated chicken.
It's not. And there's so many ways in which we're, as Belinda was saying, we're going to be paying farmers to do the right thing, but they won't be able to carry on doing that if they're going to compete with farmers from America or Australia that don't have to use the same standards of pesticide use or animal welfare or, in fact, labour, treating labour decently. You know, they have very few standards that we'd agree with in America on labour and on animal welfare. So if our farmers have to outcompete, it will be very difficult. So there's got to be a big promise, a big legal break on that.
And let's talk about trees.
Yeah.
Because we're all in favour of trees.
Yeah.
Anybody not in favour of trees?
No.
Any tree doubters?
Even the meat eaters are in favour of trees. Yeah. But trees, I mean, you first get sort of nervous about the tree thing when Donald Trump endorses it, because he sort of endorsed this trillion tree thing.
Yeah.
And you think, okay, it can't be all good, this. I mean, trees are really good,
yeah,
but they're not the only answer, are
yeah,
they, Belinda?
I think that's it. All the party manifestos had tree planting targets in them. And that is, and trees are part of the answer, but there are other habitats that we've got that are really valuable. So the peat in the UK stores 20 times as much carbon as the trees in the UK. And yet that peat is degrading rapidly and is actually emitting carbon.
So this is a big takeout message, isn't
it?
Peatlands.
Yeah, peat is really important.
And this has been a long-standing thing.
Yeah.
And because poor old peatland is not as glamorous as trees, it's sort of not getting a look in.
Yeah, so there are these easy things that government could do to help restore peat. So at the moment it's burnt for recreational purposes. Well, so moorland is burnt and that really damages the peat, largely for grouse shooting. And then also it's still extracted for use in, you know, in our gardens, and we really don't need it.
And has the government got a policy on this?
Well, so we're awaiting a peat strategy.
Right.
P-E-A-T.
We should have a ban on peat burning.
Yeah, I mean, and we've known that for years, and it just really needs to happen.
And you were working as a civil servant, you were saying, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And this was an issue 20 years ago.
Yeah. So I couldn't actually believe it that it hasn't happened yet.
Let's talk about the farmers in this, and farmers and landowners. Because I think, you know, there's this phrase used around the climate emergency, just transition, and that's often thought of as about the just transition for fossil fuel workers. But this equally applies to farmers, doesn't it? Because lots of farmers, as a result of some of the changes you're talking about, are going to see a big transformation in their way of life.
Yeah.
What do we want farmers doing, and how do we protect them?
So, I mean, I think the average livestock farm in the UK, if you took away, you know, public money, taxpayers' money that was going into them, they'd be making a loss of £13,000 a year. So, I mean, there's a huge variety, but this is not a sort of rich sector where, you know, lots of them can go and do all these things just because they believe in them. We've got to make sure that there are the right incentives in place so that they're rewarded for doing the right thing, and also demand for products. You know, Vicky's talked about using public procurement to ensure that they're growing the right food is incentivised, but you could also use that to incentivise use of timber in construction so that there's actually a business case for them to grow trees. It's not just about subsidies. And then that all has to rest on really good, well-enforced regulations that stop damage to soils and stop sort of carbon emissions.
So what do we want farmers doing? We want them growing trees.
Yeah, and there are things like agroforestry, which is a really, really innovative way of farming, where you grow some trees and then you could graze livestock underneath or grow another crop underneath. And so that can actually be more profitable.
Shall we go to the audience?
Yeah.
Who would like to ask a question, make a comment, tell us about their diet? Yep, there's a hand over here. What's your name?
Neil.
Hi, Neil.
What's your thoughts on insects and eating insects as a foodstuff that's acceptable around many parts of the world?
Eating insects?
It's high in protein.
and low in carbon. Every few months, it's going to be the big thing.
It was on Blue Peter last week.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Made was it one they made earlier?
Loaf
or?
Of bread. They made a loaf of bread.
I've done a bit of work on this, actually, because I actually produced some cookies with the cricket flour in the office to see how well it would go down. And I have to say, when I got the flour out of the packet, it really stank of cockroaches. So I put loads of ginger and sugar in it, so it wasn't very healthy. But there is a future for insects as food. Insects as feed is the big growth area, and they're producing huge amounts of maggots from black soldier flies in their billions, and then the maggots are just crushed, you know, they're killed, then crushed, and made into a protein feed for intensive livestock systems. So that's not really the future that we want, because A, there's a big ethical issue there, and B, it's maintaining a system potentially that is not good overall.
What was the cookies like?
The cookies were great because they were very sugary and very gingery. And you can actually buy products here made of insects.
Just say what was in them? Cricket flour.
Cricket flour. Ground cricket flour. But you can only buy it
what
from overseas.
What does that mean, ground cricket flour?
The whole cricket is killed and then ground down. You can have the whole animal.
Always said no to I'm a celebrity, get me out of here. And it's sort of...
Now it's appealing after hearing about that.
I'm not sure, but maybe it's just sort of cultural.
Yeah.
We need rules about how to do it.
Not cricket.
We need rules about how to kill them as well, making sure it's fair.
Yeah.
Let's take other questions. Yep, at the back there.
My concern is this is a middle-class argument. So if you're living on a low income, on the minimum wage... and you're a single parent, and actually you support this, how do you do that?
Good question. What's your name?
Stuart.
What's the answer to Stuart's question? That is...
That's a very, very...
I mean, in a way, you could make this point about this area or lots of other areas that we're dealing with when it comes to climate emergency.
Yeah. Well, one thing to say is the climate emergency is going to come down hardest on the people who have least means to tackle it, and that's happening now in the global south. So that's one point, but I totally get where you're coming from. And there are a lot of there's a lot of work being done. In my organisation, we do a whole load of work to try and get over the problems people who have low incomes or poor contracts, 0 hours contracts, all those kind of things, and poor welfare, which is one of the reasons people can't buy decent food. So to tackle the actual income issue. But there are also lots of good recipe books. Jack Munro has a brilliant book about eating really healthy vegan food, and there is a lot out there to draw on. And I think eating fresh is going to be cheaper than eating processed.
Sort of feels like there must be a way, rather than having a meat tax, of making it just cheaper for people to buy. I mean, it must be possible, don't you think?
Yeah, and I think that's where actually supporting farmers to do certain things and grow different things and produce different foods, I think that's where there's a role for that. So then there's a greater supply of, you know, the healthy foods we want to eat, fruit and veg, and that should, you know, that should bring the price down. But
we're looking for some really great initiatives from the government around peri-urban land, getting more fruit and veg grown where they used to be grown, in market gardens around urban areas, around cities. And there's loads of brownfield sites and pony paddock and golf courses, maybe perfect to have golf courses, or we could look at that land and use it differently and get some fresh fruit and veg near to where the market is, so it's going to be cheaper, getting more direct access, and even having communities growing their own in community-supported agriculture initiatives. They're really growing. There's masses of them now where people get involved in growing their own fruit and veg.
Was there a question?
Yes. I'm Roxanne. I was just wondering what the other environmental benefits that you thought for a plant-based diet. I'm thinking of things like reducing water consumption as our population continues to grow.
Good question.
Yeah, no, absolutely. There's loads. There's also some pulses. The pulse sector, which is peas and beans and lentils, they actually fix nitrogen in the soil when they're grown. So they have their own fertilizer. And so if you're putting more of that into your rotation or into your allotment or whatever, you actually need less fertilizers. So less artificial fertilizers. So having that in a rotation can be fantastically useful for reducing those kind of runoffs, which are really bad for water systems. But also having more plants, more diversity of plants, as I said, is better for things like pollinators. We've lost a lot of our insects. We're facing insectageddon, as some people are calling it. We need to get those insects back. And need more plants as providing refuge for the insects and food for the insects is a really, really important part of the change that we need. So, yeah, more plants, more variety of plants is crucial in within the rotation, within farming, is absolutely crucial. So, and that would lend itself to people eating more plants.
Do many farms go from being farms with cattle to being farms which are about crops and fruit and veg? Is it easy to switch the use of the land?
It depends where they are. I think uplands, it's harder. But I know some farmers who are investing in agroforestry, which Belinda mentioned, you know, putting some trees in. And there's real benefits for the farmers because the trees can act both as fodder, the animals eat the trees, and a shelter. And they actually have found, I think it was something like 10% yields or higher profits when they put trees with their animals. So farmers aren't doing that.
But I think that's one of the reasons why this is so much trickier than, say, the power sector, because not that that's... you know, massively easy, but it's not just a pure sort of numbers game of switching. That, you know, it depends on each place, and that's really crucial with tree planting as well. You know, you can't plant trees on sort of species rich meadows that are actually or on peatland, which is a great carbon store. Yeah. You know, so it's hard to have these kind of universal policies that you can just do and you get the result you want. Everything has to be quite place specific, which is a challenge.
The other thing, we should be making some of these trees fruit and nut trees. I'm always in meetings, people talking about trees, and they never forget that we can actually get food from a tree and bushes as well. So that
would explain good. That. Go on.
Well, we can have fruit trees. You know, plums and apples and plums.
Right. I see.
So I just
say fruit and nut tree then.
You were thinking of a fruit and nut, weren't you? You were thinking of a Cadbury's fruit and nut.
I was thinking chocolate tree. I didn't know that fruit and nut chocolate grew on trees.
Sorry.
I mean, that is like a revelation.
But you can have a mixture where you've got fruit, nut, and then harvest it, and then you've
not,
got a,
not on
a
the
mixed
same
winter.
Tree.
Yeah, not the same tree.
Should we sort of end on a kind of reason to be cheerful?
Yeah.
Give us a reason to be cheerful in this area, because it is sort of, it's quite a lot of moving parts here. Farmers, what government does, individual behaviour changes. As you say, Belinda, it's not like the power sector. Give us a reason to be cheerful.
Well, I think it is to do with the opportunity we've now got to deliver a really good system of supporting farmers to genuinely do things that we all benefit from, and that includes reduced greenhouse gas emissions, but also really restore nature. And, you know, if someone had said to me a couple of years ago that we'd be in this place with the, you know, National Farmers Union having set a net zero target, you know, lots of farmers...
For 2040.
Yeah, for 2040. Lots of farmers like the Nature Friendly Farming Network doing lots of really positive stuff. You know, I probably wouldn't have believed it. So I think we are... you know, on the right trajectory. We're at the bottom of it, but we are heading in the right direction.
Vicky?
I suppose I'll go on the demand side. You know, people are beginning to really embrace better diets and less and better meat and looking for good meat, and that they, you know, those kind of farmers are doing well, and they need to be supported, pasture-based farmers and those kind of things, but also people changing their diets to reflect not just health benefits, but environmental benefits. That's a good thing.
Okay, please thank our guests, Belinda Gordon and Vicky Hurd.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Right, shall we bring on our final guest? Please welcome to stage one of our finest comedians. He is just excellent. It's a treat to have him on. It's Robin Ince.
I loved your conversation about the insects and humane murder of them, because it reminded me on I do a radio show called The Infinite Monkey Cage with Brian Cox.
Now, how does that go? So I'm interested to know how it would go for somebody who had a successful but relatively successful career to then latch onto somebody who looms large in the national consciousness and do some kind of audio product.
Do you know what?
Can that go well for a person?
Now, initially, my limpet-like action towards a theoretical physicist looked like the wrong turn in my career. But it turned out it was excellent. Yeah, it's been very... it's a really weird thing to see where that's all kind of gone. But sorry, I was just going to tell you that when we had some insects on once, like just to, and again, it was about the same thing in terms of, you know, the diet, the way we have to change it. And Brian is a real bon viveur. You know, he loves his kind of, oh, I love me merso. He's one of those wine people who drinks wine and always has to go, I'm getting buttery mash. Are you getting buttery mash? Buttery mash and burnt toffee, right? That's the trick you have to say. And the insects came out and he went, oh, I can't eat that. And he'll eat anything, right? Anything that's more sentient. He loves the idea of its murder. But for some reason, insects went, oh, no, I'm not going there with those crickets. Anyway, just so you know, he says I do his voice too camp, and he's probably right. Anyway, sorry.
Robin, we asked you to bring along some ideas. You are the man with a brain the size of a planet, so we've got an embarrassment of riches here. What do you fancy diving into first?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the first thing is, in terms of reasons to be cheerful, because that's what you asked me, is regulations or... And I genuinely believe there should be compulsory stargazing, that at least once a month, everyone in this country should be made to go out into, you know, somewhere also preferably which is quite nice and kind of dark. You know, there's a lovely place, Hurst Monceau. I don't know if any of you know Hurst Monceau, which is where the Astronomer Royal used to go. It's kind of its own down near Eastbourne. Beautiful, dark area to just observe the sky. Because I think one of the things that we don't do, we don't get that sense. At the moment, I find it fascinating. Euston, because all the big buildings have been knocked down, immediately there's so much more sky.
And is you that really, true?
Yeah, the for whatever, so the huge
HS2,
tower blocks
this
have
is
gone.
An HS2 thing.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. And the moment you walk out, you realise how impoverished people are when they are, you know, remaining in cities, of actually seeing the sky above them, and whether that is the beauty of cloud formations, or whether when you look up and you see, like, the lovely thing is when you start looking up at the night sky, you will, anyone who's done this will know that it starts off and you see a few of the brightest stars, but as time goes on, more and more of them come into your vision. And I think that sense of our place in the universe, like if anyone here has ever, I was doing a book festival in Totnes, and I had this wonderful bit, when people come up to me surreptitiously, there's always something quite intriguing, like once an 11-year-old came up to me and just went, sorry, I have a question for you. I'm wondering, how can I test for certain that I'm not actually merely part of someone's dream? Right, those are the kind of things people want to come up, and that was beautiful, and we spent like half an hour trying to work out how you can test that. And this time, this woman came up to me, she was in her late 20s, she went, I hope this isn't too rude, but there's a secret garden just behind the house here, and my partner set up a telescope, and he wondered if you'd like to look at the rings of Saturn. Right, and
we all know what was going on there.
It was the rings of Saturn. And that to me is, someone once said to me, do you ever get disappointed when people come and ask that and don't want to kind of, you know, and I go, no, what a much better thing. And if than you, someone and it's so
and
beautiful.
If you did, and is it better to just look, or is it best to look with sort of knowledge or guide or guiding yourself?
Knowledge, good thing or a bad, Robin?
No, but do you want to know? I mean, so you know that's the Milky doodah.
Yeah,
the milky doodah.
You know a fruit and nut, but you're calling it the milky doodah.
You know, that's the
I'm afraid, Mr. Cadbury, the milky doodah has been perceived to be too Freudian in the marketplace. I think initially it doesn't matter. I mean, I think this is a very important thing about science generally, and a lot of these ideas, which is do not immediately fear approaching them because you don't have the information that you think is required.
Do you always see something new?
Yeah. Yes. I think you will always... Yeah, it's that moment. I think it's something that we don't do as human beings enough, which is that moment of stopping and just looking. You know, when we go around, you know, walking around London or walking around, so every single time there'll be a certain moment where you stop.
What's the most exciting star-related discovery in the last decade?
Well, I mean, I suppose the most exciting thing, which is not observable if you just, you know, kind of lie in a meadow, but the fact that a black hole has been properly observed and has actually been, you know, we have an image of a black hole.
Oh, that's
because,
right.
Because a black hole is, you know, until that moment, technically, they were still theoretical, right? So that is a very beautiful thing, which is, yes, it was, you know, like many things in science, once the maths works, once they've got the equation, they go, but it means it does exist, the equation works, you know, and that does kind of happen. But that moment is an incredible...
And where is that black hole?
Do you know what? I can't give you the exact, because I don't want you going there and ruining it, because then it will become, much like the Galapagos Islands, it will end up becoming a tourist destination. Exactly. Oh, look, there's footprints all over the event horizon, and you can't get them out. And
you know what a black hole is, really?
It's a point of such... Right, if you think... Right, so this is always an interest, because I normally have a man to do this kind of work for me. And,
so you listen to what Brian says.
Yeah,
then.
I listen. My job is a professional idiot. My job when we tour around is to watch the audience and see the bit where they go, I don't know what he's talking about anymore. Yeah. And I come on and do a Brian Blessed impersonation for a while, and the audience assimilate what he's said. And then they go, we understand it now. Maybe go back to the pretty young thing. And I go, yes, you may.
Brian Blessed is from Ed's constituency.
Yeah. I love Brian Blessed.
But go on, tell me what a black hole is.
How would Brian Blessed describe a black hole?
It's bloody enormous! Look at I can take that bastard on, though! You think you're a singularity?
Anyway, so, I do like my voices.
I mean, very good.
But it's something of such... So the Earth has mass.
Yep.
And the Earth's mass...
With you so far,
So gravity, that's why...
Just about,
As things become more massive, a neutron star, for instance, I think... I'm trying to think now, I can't remember the exact weight of the matter of a neutron star. A teaspoonful of that, I think, is something like 10 trillion kilograms. I'm making that up, but it's...
Might be 12, incredible. I think.
As you get more and more... As things get that power... So a singularity, the black hole... is an incredible density, but is so it's the end of a star which has now reached such a tiny, like, but it's still all of that matter now condensed that nothing can escape from it. So gravity, anything that goes in cannot, and that includes light, cannot go back out again.
Ask this question, because it's not very cheerful, but will this happen to the Earth one day?
No, we'll die from lots of other things, so don't worry about that. It's the good thing is we won't see any of the big dramas.
Why doesn't it happen to us, then?
Because we're not a star. It requires... It's very often about the mass in the first place. So the sun, for instance, it won't turn into a black hole. It will kind of, you know, it will peter out. It will swell into a red giant. It probably, I don't think, will, for the most recent thing that I read, I don't think it does actually have that burst which will destroy the Earth. But by that point, we won't be here. The conditions will not be for living things. Right. But it's also, remember, this is...
Somewhere off,
this is a beautiful thing, which I also find fascinating, is that sometimes when you hear these stories, they terrify us, and yet they are so far ahead. We have so many other things to deal with, and in our short lifespan, so many joys to find. Don't worry about the sun swelling into a red giant, right? There's a lot of other, you know, frankly, I've seen who's in the current cabinet, and there's a lot of other issues to deal with, a lot of human issues to deal with. There's a lecture, I can't remember which scientist was saying that, and it was talking about the end of the sun, the end of the planet Earth, and someone came up and said, I'm so worried, you said the sun was going to swell into a red giant, destroying the Earth, and did you say in 5 million years? And so, no, 5 billion. They went, oh, thank heavens for that. Now, you know, that's kind of... So I think, you know, that it's an interesting, it's not of all the kind of reasons not to be cheerful, that's not one of them.
So you've got some ideas which could make the world a more...
I've just realised we haven't actually really done that, any of that.
We can rattle through. We could do a couple of minutes on each. Some ideas which could make the world a better place if implemented. Give it your first one.
I think all newspapers should be packaged the same as pornography in newsagents. So, you know the way that pornography is on the top shelf? I know, by the way, about the top shelf because it's where they keep Viz as well, which is ridiculous. People still give you a look when you buy Viz.
I know.
A woman at my local WH Smith, my husband used to buy that, I won't let him anymore. It's bloody Viz. Yeah. It's just some comic
And you
strip.
Can't buy it on the self-service machine at WH Smith.
No, it does a light, doesn't it? And everyone thinks you brought something. I'm merely buying Viz. It's a comical magazine from the Northeast. But so I think one of the problems we have with in terms of our newspapers is even if you don't read the newspapers, you go in and you see all of the headlines. And I'm kind of quite anti, I'm afraid, the British newspapers as a whole. I think, you know, George Orwell was right in the fact that propaganda was not actually, you didn't need it in England because they just print whatever you wanted anyway. And I find it tremendous.
So even if people don't buy them, you think they still have...
Yeah, they've still seen it. And I mean, one of the other things that I mentioned was I would love to see the end of the review of the newspapers every morning on television and on radio, because that's not reviewing the news. It's reviewing what has already been filtered and decided is going to be the news. And that's a very different thing. And I think there's so much... I find it so discouraging when... Like, there was a story, I'll just use a reasonably banal story that I saw people getting very cross about a few weeks ago, which was apparently Cambridge University Freshers' Fair had banned the army from being at the Freshers' Fair, the careers fair, right? Now, it took me 3 minutes on the internet to find the direct source of actually the story. And that's not the story at all. What they said was that they didn't want any of the careers fair people bringing guns and arms generally. Sounds which, as reasonable. Far as I remember, I don't remember any career fair where that. So it's not even a thing that was. And then someone said, I saw all these people raging about it, and I said, but this is actually the story. And no one cared by then because they wanted to maintain their anger. They were more the enjoyment of the fury. These bloody snowflake teenagers who don't allow the firing of Uzis anymore. Just during the innocent moment in a Freshers' Fair, where yes, occasionally a pigeon or an elk is killed, but that's the way of things, right? So I think it bleeds through, and we like to think of ourselves as free thinkers. You know, if I always worry anyone who actually describes themselves as a free thinker, I think immediately has probably just read a Jordan Peterson book and made up their mind about their lobster fetishism. But I think it's very unhealthy. And from your experience, I don't want to bring it, but your treatment, I felt there were things that would just bleed through.
Didn't go so well.
Yeah, and it was not fair. And I genuinely don't, and I mean that. I think, and that's the, unfortunately, it also sets the agenda. I think a lot, I mean, my dad at 90 years old, by the way, 90 years old, changed, he'd read the Telegraph his whole life. And he rang me up and he said, Robin, I've been reading the Telegraph now for 70 years. And do you know what? I've just realised it's rubbish. I don't want to read it anymore, right? And he said, do you think I should start a subscription to The Guardian?
Wow.
And so at 90 years old, about 89 years old, he now reads The Guardian. And everything is so different for him. He hasn't seen, you know, and it genuinely is a very different newspaper for him than anything that he'd read before. And I think he realizes as well how much some of his ideas about the world were shaped by, because most of us like to imagine we're critical thinkers, but we're not really.
Newspapers would be in the bags that they sell mucky books in.
Yeah, so you've got to, you know, and some of them will be on higher shelves than others.
And how would this affect, like, the free newspapers that they give out on public transport?
Well, that's the thing, you see. This is one of my rules, is also you are no longer allowed to read the newspaper on your commute in. Because I think we start the day very often, we almost instantaneously make ourselves depressed. Because bad news, miserabilism, spite and envy are the things that predominantly sell in newspapers. That means that you wake up in the morning and there's the newspaper and, oh dear, oh, she's awful, isn't she? Oh, young people have done a thing. So the Metro is no longer given out, right? Instead, the vendors of Metro give you a painting each morning, right? So you go to work with a JMW Turner or your Yoikusama or a Stanley Spencer, and you sit on the, maybe five, you can have five paintings if you want, right there, and you just sit there staring at beauty. So to start the day looking at beauty rather than looking at kind of, you know, venality and spite, I think would be, once I stopped reading the newspapers, and people can say things like, where'd you get your news from? Well, actually, do you know what? A lot of it doesn't necessarily matter. If I actually count the number of times that I have taken genuine, positive and useful action after being depressed by a news story, it's very limited. You know, I'm not of that generation which went off and fought in the Spanish Civil War. So all the news does to me is go, oh, humanity! And that's it. It hasn't created anything positive. So I think that in some ways, distancing ourselves from that, I think Stanley Spencer always used to start the day. He's one of my favourite painters, such an interesting and eccentric individual. And he would always start the day by listening to Bach, listening to a piece of his music. And he said to start with something that magnificent at the beginning of the day means that then he would go, so he'd go out with his little cart, with his paints and his canvas, and he'd think, right, now I'm going to try and paint the best thing that I can. So I think that thing of starting with positive human achievement and remarkable human achievement.
So are we having Robin Ince's reform of Fleet Street?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, that one gets in. I think we've got time for just one more idea. And I noticed,
so sorry, I'm overly verbose.
I noticed you brought something with you.
Oh, yes. This
is remiss of me not to ask you about this.
This is, what I thought would be a nice idea. I thought all men... Again, this is one of my regulations. All men should be taught to knit or embroider.
I think it's a really good idea.
I just would love... Because I think, again, it's about this way of... There's one of my favourite human beings that fascinates me. Is a man called Ernest Thesiger. I don't know if any of you know. Ernest Thesiger was a wonderful actor. He was in two of the great kind of camp horror films of the 30s, The Old Dark House and Bride of Frankenstein. And he fought on the Western Front in the First World War, and then he was injured, his hands were injured, and he was invalided out. He was also a keen embroiderer. And he decided it'd be a rather wonderful idea if those soldiers who were now bedbound, who'd been injured, were taught to embroider so they could make money. And of course, a lot of the kind of top brass, it's a terrible thing, young men embroidering, where will this lead? To beauty. And we don't want beauty. And so when I was reading about him, he's also one of my favourite stories, where he was once interviewed about what it was like on the Western Front. And I said, Ernest Thesiger, what was it like on the Western Front? He went, the noise. And the people, the noise and the people. And he just had this, and there's beautiful images of him. He played Polonius in Laurence Olivier's Hamlet. And you see pics of him just at the side of the stage, fully dressed as Polonius, just embroidering. And I trust people who knit unless they're near a guillotine.
Have you ever knitted?
I've never knitted. I'm sort of quite cack-handed. How do you think Justine would feel about you not bringing a cookbook home, but bringing a knitting patterns?
I think I'd stab myself, honestly. I'm sort of quite worried about the knitting. I think it could go quite wrong.
I think embroidery, then. Start with embroidery.
Do you think?
Or even, you know,
I did embroidery at school. Is that possible?
Yeah.
So? I'm not sure I was...
Scientifically.
Not sure I had great aptitude for it. Would you...
I'm into it as an idea, though. It sort of ties into not just beauty, but mindfulness as well.
Yeah.
Can we add the last one more, which is you want us to cut our opinions by a third?
Yeah.
I like this idea.
This comes at, it's stolen from a wonderful man called Neil Postman, who some of you might have read some of Neil Postman's books. He wrote a brilliant book called Amusing Ourselves to Death, which was tremendously prescient. And his initial idea was, who really won in their imagining of the future? Was it Aldous Huxley or was it George Orwell? You know, which version is it? Do we live in 1984 or do we live in Brave New World? And in the book, very early on, he says, cut down your opinions by a third. I think we could probably do that, say, probably by two-thirds now, because we've so kind of fetishized, you know, this is what runs Twitter, doesn't it? I've got an opinion. I think it's going to be popular. Ooh, only three likes and no retweets. New opinion. Like that. And then you get told off. I'm a little bit disturbed, Robin. You don't seem to have had an opinion today about the fact that Heinz are redesigning their salad cream bottle. And, you know, I'm just not, you know, that thing of being, or the fact that so much opinion is negative. Like when I write, I kind of use social media, but I try as hard as possible. If I see something that I don't like, you know, whether it's a film or you know, radio show that I've listened to, whatever it is, I don't tweet about it. Because I think also one of the things with our opinions is they, again, the negative kind of thrive. There's so many things you just don't need an opinion about. And so many things where your opinion can be, here's something I saw that was magnificent. Like the Aubrey Beardsley exhibition, by the way, at the Tate Britain. It's bloody fantastic. You know, that to me is... So I think if we just think, why do I need an opinion on this? Perhaps I don't. And again, I think this all... So much of it feeds back to the newspapers. So much of it feeds back to... That's what it's... You know, so much of what is in our newspapers is... It's someone's opinion. And so, and they have this... Oh, sorry, I'm talking to you.
Well, no, can we all pledge to reduce our opinions, emissions and opinions, by a third? Yeah. Robin, thank you so much. It's always a joy. Robin Ince.
Thank you.
Woo!
Time for us to go.
It is. Thank you so much for coming tonight. We should thank our guests.
Belinda Gordon and Vicky Hurd.
And Robin, you just saw there. Also, Emma Corsham, Joel Pearce and Joe Kenyon, who produced tonight. And Thor, who's been doing the sound.
Oh, yes, yeah, Thor. Let's hear it for Thor.
Thank you so much for coming. We've enjoyed it enormously. We don't get to do so as many of these as we'd like, and it's the first one we've done in ages.
And we're pleased that we've sort of, you know... carried the show has carried on, aren't we?
Absolutely. So thank you so much for coming. Lots to think about.
Stay safe.
Yeah. All right. He's been Ed Miliband.
He's been Jeff Lloyd.
And these have been Reasons to be Cheerful.
Thank you very much.
Spin your passion into a business with Shopify and break sales records with the world's best converting checkout. Let's hear that one more time. The world's best converting checkout. Shopify's legendary checkout makes it easier for customers to shop on your website, across social media, and everywhere in between. Now that's music to your ears. Any way you spin it, you can be a smash hit with Shopify. Start your $1 a month trial today at shopify.com/records.